see if we can get this going. Okay, it's on? On. Okay, good afternoon. You had a week's break last week. I hope we didn't forget how to learn Medrash. Right, next week is, God willing, the last week in the series. I still haven't decided what to do next year. I've heard feedback both ways. The only thing I do know is that I expect to move back to the 1:30 time from the 12:30. I think 1:30 worked for a lot of people. From 12:30 was difficult. So I do expect... It'll still be Tuesday. Yeah. But in terms of the topic, I don't know. My heart's with Medrash right now. It's a lot of fun. But on the other hand, it demands a lot of text sensitivity, and that's not, the skills involved are hard. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll figure something out. But there will be something, God willing. In any case, we are still loading the boat. And I can now tell you definitively, we'll be loading the boat for the rest of the year. Yes. You have a question already.
A few weeks ago, you mentioned the entrances were from the corners.
So it appears, yeah, the edge.
I've never seen a house with an entrance at a corner. But at the corner of Plain Grove, just before you get to Shomer Shabbos,
yeah,
is a brand new house with an entrance right at the corner.
Okay, very good. They could put up a sign. They could call it Noah's Ark. Okay. There you go. So we've already dealt with in this section the question of Vani Hineni, the way God introduces his covenant with Noah to take care of him. We talked about the meaning of the word Mabul and the phrase Mabul Mayim, which does not mean what the world thinks it means. We talked about the description of the animals and the people as dying Yigva and what Yigva means. We talked about the covenant God makes with Noah. And now, we're looking at the end of Perek Vav Pasuk Yud Chet, chapter 6, sentence 18 in Bereishit. It's the first source on the page. Hashem says to Noach, Vakimosi es brisi itach. He says, I am going to uphold my covenant with you. We now know that is a covenant that the produce will not decay, rot, deteriorate on the boat, and that God will protect Noach from those outside the boat who want to keep him from going in. That was what we saw 2 weeks ago. And then Hashem says to Noach, Ubasayel hateva, you're going to enter the boat. Ata, you. Uvanecha, and your sons. Viishtecha, and your wife. Unishevanecha, and your sons' wives. Itach, with you. And the obvious question that we are going to ask at this point regarding the second half of the sentence is... Right. Well, the order and the enumeration at all. Mm-hmm. Tell me Noah is going in and tell me his family goes in. You're enumerating everybody involved. And yes, you are segregating them by gender. It's an odd thing. Now, the truth of the matter is that it's not as unique as one might think. Take a look, please, at source number 2. This is when Joseph is down in Egypt, and he calls his family, and they come down to Egypt. And when they descend, we are told, source number 2, Vayavohu Mitzrayma Yaakov v'chozer oito. They came to Egypt, Yaakov and all of his children with him. Banav, ubnei banav ito. His sons and grandsons with him. Binosav, uvenos banav. His daughters and his sons' daughters. We only know of Dina as his only daughter. Were there other daughters, and according to the Medrash, born with some of the other brothers? Potentially. That could be who's meant when it says his daughters. But they are along with him. V'chol Zaro and all of his seed. Hevi ito Mitzrayma. He brought with him to Egypt. So here also, we break down the list by gender. However, in this list, we don't split husbands and wives. The wives are not mentioned in this count. They actually are separate. In our verse with Noah, it actually mentions the wives and splits them up from their husbands, and it does it not once but twice. Take a look, please, at source number 3.
There's another thing that...
Yeah.
Noah was an old man.
Yeah.
And so he most likely had grandchildren. So that generation has not been mentioned.
Interesting. We don't have any mention of grandchildren here for Noah. You are certainly correct that he is old at this point. At least, you know, don't say it to his face because he might be insulted. But we're told that Noah is actually 600 years old. So I think once, you know, I mean, granted in the pre-flood days, 500 may be the new, I don't know, 50. Nonetheless, you can't tell me that Noah is not old at this point, but his kids are only born a century before the flood. Only. But there is discussion about this and whether there was actually a deliberate attempt of we're not bringing life into this world in its current state. There is discussion about that. The lack of grandchildren, the apparent lack of grandchildren. Sheila, you were going to say? Okay. So take a look at source number 3, please, because actually we're not just seeing this segregation once, we're seeing it twice. That was Hashem's instruction to Noach. Look at the execution, Bereshit 7:13. Be'etzem hayom hazeh, which I translated as on that very day. The Medrash picks up on the etzem hayom hazeh because there are a few cases in the Torah where a date is defined as on that very day. Can you think of another example in the Torah where a day is described as, or an event is described as occurring on that very day? Yeah. Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim, right, when we get out of Egypt. What else? Nope. The Bris Milah for Abraham. Be'etzem hayom hazeh nimolu Abraham v'Yitzchak b'no, or v'Yishmael b'no, I should say. And on that very day, it says that the Bris Milah happened. There's a fourth also. But the Medrash says that regarding these three events, they were all, so to speak, in-your-face events. These were all events in which someone said they're going to prevent something, and the Torah says it happened despite their objections, and it happened in the middle of the day to show them you have no power over this. So Abraham goes out to do the circumcision, a statement to the world of his loyalty to God, Be'etzem hayom hazeh, for all the world to know about. The Jews get out of Egypt, and anybody who thinks they're going to stop them is given a shot, and they still can't do it. And Noah goes into the boat, Be'etzem hayom hazeh, at the heart of the day, and all those who said, we're going to stop him, are unable to do so. There's more to say on that theme. I just throwing that out there because it's the beginning of this verse. But Be'etzem hayom hazeh, on that very day, Ba Noach, v'shem v'cham v'yefes b'nei Noach. Along comes Noach, along with his three sons, Shem, Cham, and Yefes. V'eshes Noach, and the wife of Noach. We identify her traditionally as Naama, but right now her name is Eshes Noach. Ushloshes Neshei Banav, as well as his sons' wives, Itam El Hateva, they came along with them to the boat. So once again, you have the segregation. Not only that, but take a look at source number 4. In source number 4, what do we see? This is the end of the trip. This is when they are leaving the boat. So Hashem says to Noach, Tzei min hateva, depart from the boat, ata v'ishtecha, you, your wife, ubanecha, your sons, unshevanecha, and your sons' wives, itach, with you. What happened when they left the boat? Husbands and wives are together, exactly.
You know what this reminds me of? In the Shevah Brachas, it's first katan v'kala, and then katan imkala.
Imakala, right. So you talk about where do you see an im?
Well, it's on the last one, it's you with your wife, your sons.
Well, that's just my translation.
Uh-huh.
In the Hebrew, it's you and your wife,
okay,
and your sons, and your... The only with is the itach at the end of the sentence, which I think is consistent across the board. Yeah. But what happens here is the husbands and wives are rejoined when they leave the boat. So clearly we could observe, because we've learned over the course of a year to be sensitive to language, we could observe that there is some kind of distinction being made. You enter the boat single, so to speak. You leave the boat married. And so our Medrash is going to deal with this. But what we're going to see in our Medrash is most peculiar. So on a philosophical level, we're going to see a lesson, but also from a structural level, it's going to be strange, which is good, because I have an hour. So, if you take a look at the Medrash, Ata, Uvanecha. It's commenting on the words you and your sons. Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon, Rabbi Chanan b'shem Rav Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak Amar. Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon. Remember that Bereshit Rabbah is Israeli. Therefore, the name Shimon becomes Simon. Simon. So Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon and Rabbi Chanan, in the name of Rav Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak, said, Noach kishenichnas l'teva ne'eser lo pirya v'rivya. When Noach entered the boat, procreation was prohibited for him. In what is really a landmark reversal, in the sense that the very first desire God expresses in the Torah, so to speak, is pruervu, for the animals and the human beings to multiply. He wants us to fill the earth. Now he says, stop, I don't want you to do so. Now, if you ask me, the reason not to do so is very logical, right? You don't really want to add to the population on the boat. Right? Let's maybe, you know, wait until the year is over. But let's see what happens. Noah enters the boat. He is prohibited from procreation. And so the verse says, as we read, you're going to come to the boat, you and your sons, le'atzman, as one group, separately. And your wife and the wives of your sons, also, separately. Kevan she'yatza hitirlo. When Noah left the boat, then God permitted it, as we saw in source number 4. Thus it says, get out of the boat, you and your wife, your sons and their wives. So Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon has given us a basic explanation. What is missing from his explanation?
The reason.
The reason. He simply stated a fact. They're separated going in, they're joined together when they leave. But he hasn't said why. Next line. Amar Rabbi Avun. Rabbi Avun says, Ksiv, Bechoser ubechafan galmud. This is not a simple verse, what you're seeing here. Bechoser ubechafan galmud. If you flip the page for a moment to source number 13, I bring you the full verse that he's quoting. Bechoser ubechafan galmud. Ha'orkim tziya emesh shoah umishoah. And that word shoah that you see in the Hebrew is indeed the word shoah. That's the word that's used for the Holocaust. So it takes a clause here, which we don't understand yet because it's taken out of context. But the opening part of the sentence, in lacking and famine, galmud. He takes that and does the following with it. If you go back to our medrash now. In lacking and famine, alone. He takes the word galmud to mean alone. In lacking and famine, alone. What does that mean? So the Medrash says this is what it means. Im ra'isa chisaron bala olam, v'chafan bala olam. If you see lacking come to the world, if you see famine come to the world, galmud, be alone. See your spouse as though the spouse was galmuda, a widow. Where do you get this word galmuda to mean a widow from? Shekein bekrache hayam korin lenida galmuda. For in the cities of the sea, they call a nida, nida meaning a woman who is separated from her husband because of period bleeding. So see her as galmuda. They call, in those cities by the sea, they call a nida galmuda. I don't understand anything of what we just read. So, you know, and we're in good company. I understand it only because I spent a while in advance of the class. But the... Rabbi Avin is getting across an idea, though. He's adding an explanation somewhat for what Noach is doing. Based on what we just did here, what Rabbi Avin did, I now understand that Noach being told it's time for the males and the females to be separate for the duration of the flood is tied to the idea that when there is some form of suffering in the world, they're supposed to separate. It still hasn't given me a full explanation for why. We still have to get there. But that's what we now have. And there's a third line. Amar Rabbi Huna. Rabbi Huna said, Ksiv, we have another verse, biblically. Uli Yosef yulad shnei banim b'terem tavo shnas hara'av. To Yosef were born two sons before the arrival of the year of famine. What point is Rabbi Huna trying to say? Why does he say this? Exactly. Once the famine came, as predicted in the dream of the Pharaoh, then they didn't have any more children. Yosef and Osnat separated. Okay. Do you have any questions about this Midrash besides what are you talking about? Like anything more specific? Yes, Marilyn.
What's the business of the city by the sea? Why is that called the Galmuda in cities that are near the water?
Good. Okay, we're going to see actually a very interesting thing happen with those cities of the sea. So hold on to that question.
And is there some relation between this idea of cities of the sea and the water flood?
Right. So it's an interesting question. I would wager not, for reasons that we'll see, but not for another half hour or so. What else? Yeah.
I don't know if I'm right, but I think that what they're meant to see is God's compassion, even in the most horrible time, even in what is perceived as justified destruction. Everybody is still his child.
Mm-hmm.
And the great sadness of the world has to be recognized by everyone who's involved.
Right. There's a lesson in empathy. Exactly. Even though God has told Noah in no uncertain terms, and we spent weeks analyzing it, right, that the people deserve what they're getting, that they're cruel people, that they stole for the sake of stealing, that they undid the entire system of justice in their abuse of other people and so on, nonetheless, you have to have empathy for the people outside the boat. It's not right for you to do what you're doing in the boat and ignoring the fact that people are suffering outside.
Is that because cruelty was an affirmation of life?
Potentially. Potentially. I'm going to come back to this because at the end I want to talk about this more. But quite possibly. It's the antithesis of thinking about the suffering of others.
Yes.
Okay, let's take a look at this Midrash. There's a lot to see here. Joyce? Excellent. Mission accomplished. Okay. So let's see what we can do with this. First of all, key question that I have is, why do I need Rabbi Avin and Rabbi Huna? Let's say I understand the first part to say that this is a statement of they should be separate, empathy, whatever explanation I'm going to give philosophically for it. What is added by bringing in Eov? What is added by bringing in Yosef? So, let me throw the question over. What would you say is being added, let's say, by the Yosef line? The fact that he quoted a verse that shows that Yosef's kids were born before the famine, and accepting the stipulation that that means that he didn't have kids and there was no procreation going on during the famine. Why did you need that in our Midrash?
Maybe it just adds strength to the original prohibition. And maybe it just gives an example later on of something that falls into that same framework of that prohibition.
Right.
So it stresses that prohibition.
Right. So maybe it's simply a reinforcement. Right? It's a reinforcement of the idea. Look at what happens with Yosef. That mirrors what we're talking about happening with Noah. Could be. Yes, Shana.
Isn't Yosef referred to as tzaddik?
Yes.
So maybe the idea is that you might expect that someone who was righteous would be allowed to procreate even under such dire circumstances, but this is to tell you not.
Right. Or that this is a function of his being tzaddik.
Yes. Yeah. An example.
Yeah. It's interesting because the Midrash asks why it is that Yosef is called a tzaddik. And there's a beautiful idea in the Midrash Tanchuma on Parshat Noach, which says there are only two people who are identified in Chumash as tzaddik. Who are they?
Noach
and Yosef. Those are your two. What's the common denominator between Noach and Yosef? Two syllables.
They save the world.
They save everybody around them. Yosef, by helping Egypt and the entire region survive the famine, and Noach with what he does with the boat. So that the definition of the tzaddik is the one who acts on behalf of others. And so that would fit with the empathy here. Yosef in Egypt and Noach on the boat both have. Yosef has access to all the stores of Egypt. Noah has his life on the boat, and yet their state as a tzaddik makes them say, this is inappropriate right now. So that argument could well be made that there's a Yosef-Noah link. You still have to figure out Eov. Now keep in mind, all year long we've been seeing Bereshit Rabbah link Eov with Noah. Right? It seems like every other Medrash links Eov with Noah. Whether because they're both not Jewish, or whether because of other things. We've been doing the Noah-Eov thing literally from the beginning of the year. But let's do more with this. Okay. The connector in what?
Noah and Eov. I mean, they're completely different people, completely different circumstances.
Maybe. You missed a bunch of weeks. They have to catch up on the recordings. But let's see. Let's see where this goes. Because there's a lot to do. Go for it.
Is this word Galmud used in contemporary Hebrew?
Would you say Galmud is used in contemporary Hebrew? I haven't heard people use it, but... Ken Betach, there you go.
What?
Yeah, it is used. Our Israelis say yes.
In what sense?
Well, to refer to somebody who's desolate, I think. We're going to see its uses in Tanakh, and I think it'll become more clear. So, here we go on this Medrash. I think we have here a key lesson regarding Medrash, which we've seen elsewhere as well. But here it's really highlighted. Look closely at the structure of this Medrash, please. Hebrew or English, doesn't matter. How many Midrashim do you see here? If a Medrash is an analysis of language, right, which has been the linchpin of everything we've done, that Medrash is about the ear for language. If a Medrash is an analysis of language, how many different analyses are going on here in the Medrash? One? Which one? Because it's analyzing the language of Bereshit 6:18? Other answers? How many analyses of language do you see going on in this Medrash? I see more than one. Yep, Galmud and Eov. That's a second one.
I'm going to go for five.
Five. Uh-oh.
Four.
What are the two in the first?
The verse about going in and the verse about coming out.
Okay.
The two in the second.
Yes.
The verse from Eov and the relationship between Galmuda and Eov.
Okay.
And then the last.
Okay. So Shane and I are on the same page, but I would take it to three and group your doubles together. But you had four. What do you get four?
Oh, I get third.
Okay. So there are really three different midrashim here being sandwiched together. It's not one midrash, it's three. Our verse is analyzing the segregated listing, granted that that includes two analyses, because it's the segregation going in and the desegregation leaving. Then, your second midrash is indeed the word Galmud as it appears in the verse in Eov. So I take that as one, because it's not a separate point about Galmud. You're bringing in the cities by the sea in order to explain Galmud as it appears in the sentence in Eov, in Job. And then, the third midrash is this one-liner from Rabbi Huna trying to understand what happens with Yosef, specifically asking, hey, why are you bothering to tell me that they were born before the famine? That must be in order to teach me a lesson. So that's a third midrash. This is really one midrash, which are three midrashim.
May I?
Yeah.
So I'm going to go back to why I thought it was four. Why are the first two where they enter and they leave one? They're two separate things. Two separate ways of thinking.
Say that again?
How they enter the boat,
right,
and how they leave has now been put together.
Yes.
But to me, they're two different instructions. And they are representative of two different times in life and the behavior accordingly.
Right. However, I think there's one operating principle that unites them.
That's the idea.
That's the idea. Right. So let's see. Let's look at this midrash again. In looking at it as three separate midrashim that have been amalgamated together. On a simple level, all three of these are together because they speak to the same theme. Separation at a time when people are suffering. Right? I think that's a straightforward common theme.
Is that a natural condition or a decision.
It's an ethical decision, I think.
It's a natural
decision. I think it's an ethical decision.
An ethical decision.
Yes. I don't think this is a natural event. I think this is a statement of, this is the way things ought to be. People should decide to do this. That's the way I look at it, but wait, because we're going to see more about that. On a deeper level, I think that there's a reason to put these three together, besides the fact that they have a common theme. In other words, I could say, as Marilyn said, that the second and third Midrash simply reinforce the message of the first. Noach separated, Eov talks about separating at a time of lacking and famine, and Yosef separated. So that strength is what happens with Noach. But I think there's more. Sharon.
I just want to ask something about Eov, and that is, when he lost everything, he lost his family too.
Yes.
His first family. He's the only one. The other two actually have this life.
Right. The lives of the three have distinct differences. But the verse in Eov is actually not talking about his suffering. Wait and see. The verse in Eov is actually not what it sounds like yet. We have to get there. On a deeper level here, the Medrash in Noach itself is weak. It's making a very big leap. You could have explained the way I did for a second earlier that the separation is not people are suffering and therefore I should separate. The separation is a practical point because we're getting on a boat in cramped quarters for a year and you have to watch out for the elephants. Therefore, we are going to say, separate because it's really not a good idea to have babies around on this boat. Right? 100 years old and plus. 100 year, you have to be 100 years old to get on this ride. I could have done that to explain the segregation. So therefore I bring in Eov, which adds the idea of separating at a time of destruction, even if you're not in cramped quarters. That generally this is a value. And then we still are missing something. Because both Noach and Eov refer to a time of broad suffering, either in Noach's case, the entire world, or in the case of Eov, an unspecified lacking and famine. We don't have details yet about who it is who's suffering in Eov's pasuk. Yosef's experience, though, the suffering is local. It's a famine in Egypt. And yes, it's going to affect those countries that depend on the breadbasket of the region. But fundamentally, it's more localized. And so what Yosef is adding is, even if it's not the entire world, nonetheless, it's appropriate to empathize with your neighbors and therefore not to engage in procreation. That's a deeper look at why these three are structured together. Each one adds something. Noach's could be for practical reasons. Eov's tells me, no, there's actually a philosophical issue here. If they're lacking, separate. And Yosef's adds, even if it's just a local thing, nonetheless it's appropriate. Ralph?
Well, that's all right for human beings, but we know perfectly well that the animals didn't procreate either, because there wouldn't have been room for them.
Well, once you tell me that there was room for two, I'll be willing to discuss what happens with their babies. It's true, we have this idea that the animals separated as well. This medrash isn't going there, though.
That would be a natural law.
Hypothetically, yeah.
So there's two laws here.
Frankly, you could make the argument, if you wanted to, that for the animals, it was a natural thing to do for a completely different reason. The animals sense a lack of resources.
Absolutely.
And therefore are not likely to breed.
Same purpose. Same
right. But I want to, having explained this medrash somewhat, having started on explaining this medrash, there is so much more we need to see. Okay? We need to understand each piece of this. Each of the three midrashim requires greater analysis. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Source number 7 is a Gemara in Beisa that's talking about a Talmudic principle. The Talmudic principle is, if a decree is issued by a court, it can only be annulled by a court. In other words, even if I think the reason for the decree is gone, it doesn't matter. I need a particular edict by the court to revoke the decree. Now, the Talmud here in source number 7 gives us an example of that from a decree that God issued. Remember that before they receive the Torah, they're told, put a barrier around Mount Sinai, don't let the animals go up the mountain. So here we are told, Ksiv, the text says, Gam hatzon v'habakar al yiru el mul ha-har ha-hu, that the sheep and cattle shall not graze beside the mountain. So the text asks, Bimshoch ha-yovel, I added in the words in brackets, Hema ya'alu bahar, Lamali, why do I need another sentence which says, when the shofar blows, indicating that the giving of the Torah is over, then you're allowed to go up the mountain. Why do I need a separate verse to tell me that when it's over, you can go up? Obviously, when it's over, you can go up. If the rule is, don't go up the mountain because God's giving the Torah, then when he's done giving the Torah, you can ascend the mountain. Why do I need explicit permission? Shema mina, the text concludes, Davar shebeminyan sarach minyan acher lahatiro, a matter declared in a quorum. When a court says something, another quorum must be convened in order to repeal it. As a side note, this proof is actually more complex than it sounds like. At first, Tosfos and Beit Sefer, if you want to be confused. But the point isn't that. I'm only bringing it not to discuss the passage from the Talmud, but to discuss the principle, which is, you need to permit afterwards. It isn't enough to say, well, the reason is over. Therefore, what we saw in verse 1, that God tells them, separate when you enter the boat, requires explicit permission in source number 4. When they leave the boat, they're told to leave together. However, there's a catch. And the catch is on the second side of the page. When they actually leave the boat, look how they leave. Vayetze Noach, Ubanav, V'ishto u'nesheivanav ito. And Noach departed, and his sons, and his wife, and the wives of his sons with him.
I always thought it was an Oriental practice.
Yeah, it's not really one of ours. There's room to discuss that, but not right now. If you look at this, at their actual departure, it says they left segregated, even though they were told explicitly, back in source number 4, leave the boat, husband and wife together. So why did they end up leaving segregated?
There were different parts of the boat that they came together in the middle. They couldn't get together, so...
Well, see, that's an interesting question in its own right. We have no mention of what the arrangements were when they were actually on the boat. We know they enter segregated. We don't actually know what the living arrangements are. In our discussions, we talked about what floor they were on. And we know that they had space for, 300 rooms or 330 rooms or whatever it was on each floor, as we discussed. But we didn't have a discussion about how they're living. We just know that they're separating when they leave. So what's going on? Classic commentator Chizkuni suggests that you shouldn't read too much into it. It's just a reversal of the way it was expressed when they entered. When they entered, they were listed separately, so therefore when they leave, they're listed separately. But that's difficult to support, because we made a point of reversing it when God told them to leave. So if you take a look at the Medrash that I brought you, source number 9, this comes from a generic collection of Medrash called Medrash Agada, later than Bereishit Rabbah. Vayetze Noach, and Noach departed. He did not accept to return to his wife and procreate. Why? He says, sure, right now, it all looks dry outside, but I see clouds in the distance. This is before
the rainbow.
This is before the rainbow. This is before the new covenant. Right. This is when he's actually leaving the boat. All the covenants that God is going to make with him are still in the offing. First, Noah has to bring his carbon, and then he'll get the promise. So he says, you know what? I'm not putting away the oars just yet. maybe we should be ready for another trip. That's the Medrash's understanding for why they remain separated when they leave. But that's the first Medrash. That's the Noach one. Okay, the Noach one is telling us that yes, God tells them they should separate, and he tells them they should rejoin, and they're not so sure. And that explains the verses that are here in Bereishit chapter 6 and in chapter 8. But then we have to go to the second Medrash, which is really the hardest of the three. This business with Eov, what in the world are you talking about? So, we need to understand the verse that we quoted. If you look at Source 13 again, this is the verse that our Medrash was using. Becheser ubekafan galmud, haorkim tzia emesh tzeshoa umshoa. Who and what is Eov actually talking about? So, the verse itself is talking about people who mock Job, who mock Eov. And this is what he wishes upon them. Sharon, this goes back to the question about whose suffering this is. Eov is talking about the people who mock him, who tell him that if he's suffering, it's surely because he's done something wrong. And he just has to analyze his deeds, or there's some justice in what he is enduring. And Eov says, you know what I wish upon them? Galmud, lacking, famine, desolation. He says, that's what I wish would happen to the people who are saying these things to me. So he says of them, in lacking and famine, galmud, running to ruins, darkness, desolation, and destruction. So there. What exactly does lacking mean in that sentence? Take a look at source number 10, the Etz Yosef's commentary to our Medrash. Choser, lacking, as it was worded in our Medrash, kitsaros chereb v'dever, like the suffering of sword and plague. Oh, chisaron kis, shehuzlu amos, shezeh kasha meirav, or loss of money when currency depreciates, which is worse than famine, because he's envisioning a situation in which there is food, but you can't afford it, because the currency isn't worth anything. There are various pieces of Jewish history that piece fits into. But the point is that our Medrash looks at this sentence, our second Medrash of our three, looks at this sentence and says, we understand very well that Eov is wishing bad things upon those who are making him miserable. That we get. But the word galmud is a word we don't understand. If you took the word galmud out of the sentence, everything would be fine. Lacking, however you explain it, sword, plague, currency is worthless, whatever it is. Lacking, famine, running to ruin, darkness, desolation, destruction, that I get. But what is this word galmud that Eov is using in reference to his enemies? What is it that he is wishing upon them? That's what we want to know. And then we have to figure out, how does it fit into the sentence? Now, this word, galmud, only appears, to the best of my knowledge, in four places within Tanakh. Three are in Eov. One is in Yeshaya, in Isaiah. Take a look, please, at source number 11. This is when Eov, Job, is cursing the night that he was conceived. He curses the day he was born and the night he was conceived. So he says of that night, Hine halayla hahu yehi galmud. That night should be galmud. Al tavo renanavo. There should be no joy on that night. That's number one. Number two is source number 12. Ki adas, this is not Eov speaking now, this is Eliphaz, one of the people who comes to speak to Eov. And Eliphaz's message is that the wicked will ultimately suffer. That's Eliphaz's message. If there are bad people out there, they're going to suffer. If there are good people out there, they're going to get good things. And your experience, Eov, has to conform to that somehow. So Eliphaz says, Ki adas chaneif galmud. The group of people involved in flattery will be galmud. Ve'esh achla ahle shochad. And fire will consume the tents of bribery. So galmud is some form of suffering that should befall the wicked. And then you have our verse in source 13, again about galmud befalling the wicked. And then the last reference is source 14. This is Yeshaya, Isaiah, speaking of the Jews. Ve'amart bilvaveich. This is the Jews after God has brought them back to Israel, after they have been saved by Mashiach, by the Messiah, ve'amart bilvavech, you Jews, you're going to say in your heart, mi yala lias eleh, where did I get all these children from? Vani shechula ve'galamuda, I was barren and galamuda. Gola v'sura, exiled and abandoned. Ve'elam yigidel, who raised these kids? Hey nani nisharti levadi, I have been alone. Ela efohem, where have they been? Where are they from? Those are the four uses of the word galmud within Tanakh. Tell me something. Looking at these verses, can you see any indication of why there would be a temptation to take the word galmud as separation of husband and wife, as lack of procreation? Yes, Shane.
King Yeshayahu,
that's what it's about. Yeah, that's one. In the use of the sentence in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, where she says, where did my children come from? I was galmuda. Shechula is a term we use to refer to someone who has lost children. Right? Dov shakul. To be shincha vavlamid is to have lost one's young. Shechula, the young I had are gone. Galamuda, and I had no spouse with me. That's one. Which other of these verses feeds that idea? Sorry? Yeah, number 11. Why? Right. It's the night of his conception, and he says that night should have been galamuda. There should have been no procreation on that night. That's Eov's curse for when he was born. So the word galmud in at least those two verses, source number 12 is harder to fit. You can, but you don't need to. But those two verses feed into the idea that to be galmud is not just a negative state, which you could glean from all four of these. It's not just a negative state, but it's to be alone and without procreation, without a mate. Now the word itself is not a Hebrew word. Galmud, gimel lamed mem dalid as your root, is a four-letter root. And as a general rule, that means it's not one of ours. In fact, I have seen it linked to an Arabic word, gimel mem dalid, no lamed, which indicates in Arabic hard or frozen, which fits because in the Talmud we have a word gamda in Aramaic, which also refers to something that is hard. They talk about namta garda, a hard felt. Namta gamda, I should say, a hard felt that they used. So the idea that this isn't a Hebrew word, and therefore our Medrash is struggling to understand it and say, what is this word that shows up four times in Tanakh, makes a lot of sense. And now I come back to Maryland cities by the sea, and I note that actually the Talmud in several places tries to explain the word Galmuda, and each time it attributes it to a different location. The Gemara in Babli, in the Babylonian Talmud in Sota, says that it comes from Krachei Hayam, the cities of the sea, like our Medrash does here. The Talmud in Rosh Hashanah, Chavav Amud Aleph 26a, says that it comes from a place called Galia, which I saw a commentary to the Medrash try to say was, bingo, Tzarfat, Gaul, right, G-A-U-L, it's France. And then the Talmud Yerushalmi traces it to a place in Africa and says it's a word from there. My point is not to actually study this word and say, well, it was actually French or it was actually African or it was actually from some island by the sea. I don't particularly know or care. The point is that the Medrash says what's bothering us is that here we have a word being used four times in Tanakh and we don't know what it means because it's not Hebrew. It's not odd to see non-Hebrew words in Tanakh. We have them from the very beginning, Gar Sahaduta, and so on. That's not a problem. The Gemara has no compunctions about explaining a biblical word based on another language. Totafot is one. There are others. Whether you're going to take it to mean that there's a word from another language that creeps into biblical text, or whether you're going to say it was originally a Hebrew word and ended up in other languages and Hebrews didn't use it, again, doesn't particularly matter. The point is that our Medrash looks at it and says, what is that? And so, the second of our three Midrashim is really just an attempt to explain the word Galmud as it appears in Iyov. And it's also not, to go back to Ralph's point, it's not that we're saying that Iyov has anything to do with the flood. We're not linking Iyov and Noach. That's not our purpose. It's simply that our Medrash looks at Iyov, Job 30, sentence 3, and says, what is it that he's wishing upon those who mock him? And the answer is, he is saying they should be galmud, because they should live at a time of lacking and suffering, and they should be unable to procreate, because that's what one does at a time of suffering. That's what Iyov is wishing upon his enemies. You follow?
Yeah.
So that's our second medrash. It has nothing to do with Noach. It has nothing to do with the flood. Our medrash sandwiches the two together because it adds something to our understanding. Because if we set it from Noach, there are any number of reasons why they might be separated as they enter the boat. But now, I have the added idea that there's an ethical separation, that it's actually, this is the way it's supposed to be. But then we get to our third medrash. And our third medrash is with Yosef. And we already said that Yosef adds a dimension, right? Yosef adds the idea that even when it's a local tragedy, nonetheless, one is supposed to separate, because otherwise, why did the Torah bother to tell me when the two kids were born? It's in order to tell me they were born before. Except that there's a problem. How many Jews went down? Jews is the wrong word, probably. How many members of the family of Yaakov came down to Egypt?
69.
70. So who's number 70? Yocheved. When is Yocheved born? Within the walls of Egypt, correct. Because when you count up how many people are listed, there are only 69, even though it says that all the souls who came down, Haba'a Mitzrayma, Shiv'im, that there are 70. So how do I understand it? Because Yocheved, daughter of Levi, is born within the walls of Egypt. Bein Hachomot. So, if she's born then, and there's a famine going on, somebody's cheating. So that's the problem. So take a look, please. And source number 15. Source number 15, commentary of Tosfot on the Talmud. The Talmud quotes this idea that we have in our Midrash with very strong language. It says, Asur la'adam l'shamesh mitaso b'shnei ra'avon, that procreation is prohibited during the years of a famine. So says the Talmud. So then they ask, Vim Tomar, you might ask, Hara Yocheved nolda bein hachomot. Yocheved was born within the walls of Egypt. Ve'oso ha'eis rav haya. That was a time of famine. Ve'alkein shimshu mitosehen b'shnei ra'avon. So they must have made it. Ve'yesh loma, you could say, de'lekulei amo lohavi asur. It's not really a prohibition. It doesn't mean that there's an ironclad prohibition. Mitzvah number 617 is going to be that you can't mate at a time when they're suffering. No, that's not the way it works. Rather, Elamisha rotze linhog atzmo b'chasidus. This is for someone who wishes to lead a pious life. Yosef is personally aggravated about what's going on in Egypt and the suffering that he's seeing in the famine, and he can't bring himself to procreate. And this is what Hashem is teaching Noach, that he should look at the world that way, which fits very well, because it's the opposite of the whole Hamas situation in which people are selfish and they take. God is saying to Noach, learn from this. You have to look out for everybody else and feel for them. V'yosef lo shimesh. And so that's what Yosef did. He didn't mate. Avol sharbenei adam shimshu. But others, including evidently his brother Levi, did. That's the way Tosfos resolves it. And I think it's a very important point, because what we're learning is that this is a matter of ethical sensitivity that the Medrash is trying to teach us. We ask this question week after week. If Medrash is really just about understanding the language, is there also a moral lesson that goes with it? And a couple of times this year we've said, no, we can't find what the lesson is that is supposed to teach us beyond understanding the text, which is fine for Medrash. But here I think we're getting a very clear message. It's a message in terms of sensitizing yourself and being empathetic in a time of suffering for others. Except, we have one more point to go. And that is looking at the ideology. By the way, just a separate point that I noted in my notes, but I'm not going to pursue here for lack of time. The idea of separating from one's spouse has other applications in Torah. Right? Like when they stand at Har Sinai and the husbands and wives separate. Or when Moshe separates from Zipporah. And the story that goes with that, with Miriam's Lashon Hara about Moshe and so on. This is a larger idea within Tanakh, and then upon that in Medrash and Talmud, this whole issue, which is where we have no time to actually investigate it, but I'm raising the point just for you to think about. But in terms of the ideology here in this Medrash, so one way to take a look at it is the way we've already looked at it, that it's about empathy, participating in the suffering of others. You know, we're told, Hashem says, Imo anochi betzara. Right? Hashem says, I am with the Jews when they suffer. So this is about the Jews saying, I am going to be with those who are suffering. They're not suffering alone. I feel it also. But there's a second idea. Take a look at source number 16, which I think is a really interesting idea, although very, very hard to accept. Medrash Tanchuma, so it's later than our Bereishit Rabbah, or at least it's canonized later, I should say. Because when the world is at a time of pain and destruction, suffering and destruction, asur la adam lihizakek bepiria verivya, one may not procreate. Shalo yehaya kadosh baruch hu osek bechorban haolam vehu boneh. Because if God is destroying, it's not right for you to build. Yes.
Can't go along with that.
Yeah, because?
Well, because intimacy doesn't necessarily only mean procreation. And under difficult circumstances, you need one another to survive.
This was something I kept... Right. This was something that I kept thinking about as I was preparing this. We're really conflating two different things. And in a sense, I think that's what the two different philosophical explanations are addressing. In other words, saying that it's really about empathy for those around you is looking at it in terms of the intimacy element. Saying that it's about building when God destroys is that it's about the procreation element. It's two different views of why Noach is being told to separate. Is it because you're not entitled to that intimacy when other people don't have it? Or is it because you shouldn't build if God is actually tearing down? Two different ways that you can look at the same idea. Rebecca.
At the same time, I agree with Rob in terms of the intimacy piece, but then in terms of the procreation piece, we often think that in times of destruction, for whatever reason, we can assume there was a reason for the destruction, there is this idea of going in the other direction for good reason and building. And if we don't build...
Give me an example of that related to the Jews in Egypt.
When Moshe's parents are encouraged to... the women encourage their husbands.
Well, the women encourage their husband, yes. And Miriam in particular is known for the whole medrash about how she told her parents to get back together. And specifically, they should have children. This is a difficult idea.
One might argue there that even though, you know, that you have this edict from God 400 years, we also have a tradition that Paro and the Mitzrayim took it to another level. So that wasn't necessarily God. One would argue that wasn't necessarily God's punishment.
Interesting. Okay. Could be.
The argument could be made. But I still would argue even when God.
So... I'm not sure how to deal with this idea. I bring it because for the sake of completeness, you have to see this other view. But I'm not sure how to look at this view either. I think that there's a lot of room for hesitation on this. Shana, you had a hand up?
It's one thing if you're specifically commanded in a certain situation not to do something.
Yeah.
But it seems to me what's being said here is don't swim upstream. It seems to me sometimes that God enjoys a good fight. And we see situations where people do swim upstream and are praised for doing it. You know, Abraham doesn't say, you know, famously, when Abraham is told by God, Sodom and Gomorrah are toast, he doesn't say, all right, that's your decision. He says, no, come on, you can't do this.
But does he move there?
No. But he argues with God. He doesn't just accept the decree.
But except that when he argues, I'm just going to, you know, slow stream as well here. They, when Abram argues to the point with God, and God says no, he says, for them to have children at this point really is like moving to stone. You know, in other words, it's more than just an argument with God. It's a statement of, you're killing everybody. I'm going to create somebody anew, and let's see what you do with him.
But how do they have children? It's not just, you know, they're three participants in the creation of a child. So if you have a child, the assumption is that this is a gift from God.
Well, that's true for everything you do.
True, but so if you're saying, well, you know, this act of intimacy in a moment of crisis is a rebellion against God's will, well, then why is God aiding and abetting your rebellion?
Right, but again, that's true for everything you do. In other words, the thief is also, you know, as Ramosha Cordovero wrote in his Tomer Devora, the thief who steals something, God is giving him the energy to move his hand. I mean, that's true. You're right that it may be more visible when you're dealing with procreation, and the Talmud explicitly, you know, makes God a partner. Nonetheless, I'm going to take two more questions, and I want to do a summary to make sure that we got everything out of this. Yeah.
If you take the stone example, interestingly enough, you have those three Malachim coming, and their message is both destruction and procreation.
That's true. That yes, okay. That's true.
Okay, and that happens simultaneously.
Well, it's a year later, though.
It's
got a few months. Yes.
I'm troubled by the role of the pious in desperate situations. That they should separate. Does that, and what that means for the whole community, and what happened, for example, in the Holocaust. Presumably they're separating so that they can pray for redemption.
Is that true?
I don't know.
We only have seen, it's an interesting question. Ralph opens up a whole new can of worms with a minute to go. And that is the purpose of separating? I mentioned before the separation at Har Sinai to get the Torah. But there, they're supposed to separate because of concern for Tahara, for purity and impurity, ritual purity and impurity involved there. Ralph introduces the idea of separating so that they can focus on praying to God. We've talked about separating because it's inappropriate for them to have their intimacy while others are being killed. So the question of what the goal is here, I think, is an interesting one. But requires another hour. But in terms of this fundamental question of understanding this medrash, I want to see if I can sum up in a way that we walk away knowing what we learned. We saw that Noach and family entered the boat with each gender separated. That was the instruction. That's the way they went in. When they left, we saw God specifically told them to go back together. Granted that they didn't, they are described as leaving separately, so we dealt with that. The Medrash's answer was that they were afraid that God was going to destroy the world. Again, the Fiskuni said, no, it's just the way it's recorded. They actually did leave together. Fine. Our Medrash brings three different Midrashim on the topic. The first Medrash it brings on, it says, yes, God is separating them specifically because he doesn't want them to mate now. Then we bring a second Medrash from Eov. That Medrash is not interested in the flood. That Medrash is interested in explaining what the word Galmud is, that Eov is wishing upon his enemies. It says that Galmud is a reference to non-procreation. It's a reference to being desolate and being alone and being separated. And that is, as the Medrash explains it on Eov, something that will apply here because it teaches me this idea that, as it's worded in the sentence in Eov, when there is lacking, when there is famine, then there should be a separation. So that offers an ethical imperative to explain why Noach is separating. And then third, we're told that Yosef has his kids before the famine in order to underscore the fact that even though it was a local type of a suffering and not a global suffering, Yosef still separates from his wife, from Asnat. We then took that idea and explain that there are really two different elements here. One is separation from intimacy, which could be understood as empathy for those who are suffering, although, as Ralph noted at the end, there are other ways that you could take the value of that separation. And then separately, so to speak, there's the idea of separation from procreation, and that would be the idea that God is destroying, and therefore he has sent a message. He doesn't want you to plant new life, which raises some very serious questions of reading God's mind and giving up, and sometimes God wants you to push back, that, you know, I think are good questions to think about. But the overarching lesson that I see here is certainly a message of empathy, and a message for those around us, and that's what we're meant to learn from this Medrash, as well as the idea of sensitivity to this divine message, all emerging from that order of things in this sentence. Our last class, God willing, next week, we're going to look at the next sentence biblically, which begins with God saying, "Umikol hachai mikol basar," that those who are going to come on the boat are from all the living, from all flesh. And our Medrash is going to want to know, what exactly is alive and not flesh? And hopefully we'll answer that question in 1 hour. God willing, next week.